You're listening to Upfront. I'm Brian Edwards Tiekert. And here in California, we are surrounded by the world's most elaborate system for moving water from the places that nature puts it to the places where it will make the most money. Our next guest started a book on that topic by trying to resolve a basic contradiction. Why, in the midst of the worst drought in recorded history in California, were the growers of our Central Valley planting more and more acreage of thirsty crops that would need more and more water just to survive? Mark Arox has spent most of his life writing about Fresno and the Central Valley, formerly as a reporter for the LA Times, now as an author and independent journalist. His newest book is The Dreamt Land, Chasing Water and Dust Across California. Mark, it's good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you.
How would you describe the Central Valley's water system to an outsider, someone who just got off the plane from another continent?
Well, it's the entire state system. Can you think of a bigger act of hubris than California? You know, except we call it here a dream. And it starts with exactly how you started. We take this edge of a continent 1,000 miles long, and we declare it one state. And the problem is that state has a dozen different states of nature inside it. So you have one spot where it's raining 140 inches a year, another spot in the south where it's raining 2 or 3, and we decide that this is the rub of California, that we're going to even out those differences. And that evening out is a massive job. And so we build this system. And the system is the Central Valley Project and the State Water Project. And it's a magnificent system. It was, it is. It created 2, if not 3, world-class cities, the most extensive and intensive farm region in the world. But the system's cracking. And what I do in this book is I go inside those cracks. And we see the shipping of water from the north to the middle all the way to the south. And this taking really begins with Los Angeles, the story we all well know. And it's stealing of the Owens River from 230 miles away. And that becomes a model for the rest of California. And so in the middle here, these farmers began, let's start with the gold rush. The mining of gold was the mining of water first. And we set up these flumes. And those flumes were nothing but wooden ditches. And they diverted the rivers. And then they figured out that if they could put that flow into a canvas hose with a nozzle on the end of it, they had hydraulic, irrigation, hydraulic engineering. And at some point, we were melting those mountains, in the gold rush so much that they were polluting the rivers. And they were silting up the alluvial plains of those rivers where we were planting our first crops. And so if California had a choice in the 1880s, were we going to be, was our future mining gold or was it mining soil? And so you see that system, that elaborate system of flumes, ditches, canals, and dams up in the Sierra, in the foothills, it moves down on the valley floor. And the very industrialists who made the most money off of gold were living in Nob Hill, and decided that they were going to farm the hinterland. And what's the first crop they plant? Wheat. And the first king is the wheat king, Isaac Friedlander. 6'7", 300 pounds. They said his stride was twice the stride of a normal man. And he ended up buying hundreds of thousands of acres in the middle of California, planting wheat. And it was a very elaborate system. I mean, he had clipper ships that were sailing the wheat. It was called California Velvet to Liverpool, and London went crazy over this California wheat. But because it was a monoculture, because they were stealing from the soil, the yields of that wheat kept going down and down and down until the wheat king decided that he'd go on to something else. And that's when California, in the early 1900s, decides that its future is a future of fruits, vegetables, and nuts.
This is a consistent theme that comes up again and again as you profile some of the barrens of the Central Valleys, is that this is not young, hardy pioneers making their way to the rural area and starting a new business. This is capital from the coasts deciding the best return on investment is going to be creating inland empires.
That's right. And the best example of that is Stuart Resnick. I mean, Stuart Resnick, his wife Linda Resnick, they started a company called Paramount. It is now called Wonderful because Paramount wasn't quite grand enough to take in everything they were doing. And Resnick's a fascinating story. I mean, I chased him down for a decade, and he finally agreed to spend a lot of time with me and tell his story. You know, he's the son of a bar owner in New Jersey, comes west to go to UCLA Law School. He becomes a millionaire while in law school, cleaning buildings. And then he takes that model and turns it into guarding those buildings with securities and security guards and security alarms. And that makes him many more million. And he goes into and buys the Franklin Mint, the maker of Elvis, dolls and, plates and things like that. That makes him some more millions. He decides as a hedge against inflation in the late 1970s, he's going to buy some land in the valley. And he is now the biggest grower of pistachios, almonds, mandarins, and pomegranates in the world. He controls about 140,000 acres of land in California, and he and his wife use more water than any couple in the state, probably any couple in the West. And that is, this empire. And, so I go inside that at a time of drought, and I see that a lot of the big guys, the small guys are paying a price in drought. They're really having to, they're taking out orchards. They're doing all they can to get by. But the big guys, paradoxically, are planting more almonds, more pistachios, and more grapes.
So I want to get into why in a second, but talk a little bit more about the kind of business model of the Resnicks. It's kind of remarkable, and I didn't realize this till I read your account of their empire building, but they're like marketing geniuses. A lot of their profits have turned on repurposing their agricultural products as health aids. They almost single-handedly created the consumer market for pomegranate juice and paid for the research to substantiate their claims that it's good for your health.
They spent $35 million to substantiate those claims. They got an Israeli scientist to do some really good tests and things like that. I mean, I drink a bottle of palm juice myself a week. It's I justify it because it's part of the Armenian culture. I mean, the pomegranate is about, it's almost a mythological kind of fruit in our culture. But yeah, I mean, they've wedded the kind of agriculture, that industry of agriculture in the middle of the state, with the marketing in the south of the state. And the way Linda did it was really something to marvel at. She started selling these little bottles of palm juice, giving them away initially to all the movie stars. They'd show up on Oscar night, sipping the palm juice. And pretty soon they were making palm teenies, everywhere in the country. So, she's the one that came up with the name Cutie to describe this mandarin that they planted. And, and they partnered up with another person who they ended up going to war with. And so they had to sell the Cutie brand. And now they invented a new one, the Halo. And so in the fields of middle of California, we have a war going on between the Cutie and the Halo. So you're right. It's this wedding of a culture, a kind of culture that, I think of that grapevine that separates the sprawl of the suburban sprawl of L.A. from the agricultural sprawl of the middle as our Mason-Dixon line. And they were able to cross that and wed those two cultures.
So what inspired them? And they're living in the urbanized South Coast. They're in a massive sprawling mansion in Beverly Hills right now. What inspired them, as a couple that's in the business of commemorative coins through the Franklin Mint and things like selling security systems for businesses, to start setting up an agricultural empire in the southern San Joaquin Valley?
Well, it was really the accountant who said, you need to diversify. So he ends up going to Delano, where Cesar Chavez basically founded the UFW, and he buys a piece of the Paramount Citrus Empire and starts from there, and the profits are incredible. And he says, boy, this is easy. And he ends up then buying a huge chunk of land in western Kern, Kings County, where this pioneer of agriculture, another giant who's gone broke, a guy named McCarthy, he ended up planting these pomegranates. And so they decide to keep the pomegranates. And, you know, the market for fresh pomegranates isn't big back then. It's actually not very big today. So they decide they're going to juice it. And so I think it was simply an investment. And then it turned into a whole mission. You know, the wonderful corporation is all about, you know, these crops that they feel are healthy, and, you know, they're changing the snack markets in America with their pistachios and almonds. They've got Fiji water to wash down those almonds and pistachios when they get stuck in your throat. And it's quite something to see. And then what they've now done 30 years into this experiment is they're trying to change the culture of the valley by changing the eating habits of their workers. And they're bringing in charter schools to try to change the education. And it's philanthropy, not unlike the philanthropy that Linda's done in Los Angeles with the Resnick Neuropsychiatric Hospital and all their donations to art. But this is different. She's actually not only writing the checks, she's creating these programs. And if you go to their headquarters outside of Lost Hills, they're serving these high-end lunches, you know, with wild salmon, all that's for $3, trying to persuade their workers to give up the tortilla, the burrito, and embrace this new kind of diet. She's trying to change the gut biomes of her workers, you know, all the way down to she's asking them to drink this little concoction she's made of apple cider vinegar, turmeric, mandarin juice, and a little ginger. And this is what they're supposed to take before they eat to create the right atmosphere in their guts to beat back diabetes.
You describe it as philanthropy. It does come across in your writing as also being kind of creepily controlling of workers who yes. are already living in what amounts to a company town.
Yeah, it's a little bit of social engineering. Everything with the Resnicks is, you know, you just look at it and it's complex. It's tough to capture the, and you're not sure what the motive is. I mean, you know, listen, we wouldn't have libraries in America if it wasn't the rich trying to wash away, you know, their guilt. So, in some ways it's almost
Andrew Carnegie financing the construction of about 2,000 libraries.
Right. And look what the family that you know created and sold opioids did. I mean, they ended up, you know, funding, you know, how many museums. So you almost don't ask yourself that question. You just look. You're in the land. You're dug into the earth. You're meeting these folks who have crossed the border, and you're seeing how their lives are being improved by the Resnicks. You know, who are giving them full-time jobs, who are giving them benefits, and then are building these schools and sending them off to college, the kids, the ones that can, and then following up as they've been sent off to college with tutors. So it's an extraordinary amount of philanthropy that really that none of the big guys in the San Joaquin Valley have ever done, except for maybe the Boswells, the cotton giants. So so it's mixed up. You know, it's one thing to be, let's say, in San Francisco, looking at this afar and being able to paint it with a very broad brush. But when you get on the land with these big growers, and it gets a little bit more complicated, if not compelling. Now, the Resnicks are farming from afar, and you know they're living in Beverly Hills, and then their empire here is in Lost Hills. 80 miles by the Crow separates those two places, but they couldn't be more different. So that's what I'm tackling as I'm in the middle, digging in, trying to figure out, you know, because 80% of the water, the captured water in California, is going to agriculture. What are these guys doing with it? That's the question.
So they're farming in the southern end of the San Joaquin Valley. It's a place that for a long time was best known as America's oil patch. It was mined for oil. They bought some of their initial land from oil companies that were selling it off at fire sale prices. Now the pomegranates, right. The nuts, the citrus, they depend on mining water. What were they doing to keep their land productive during the drought?
So here's what you have to understand. The valley is obviously two valleys. It's the Sacramento Valley, the San Joaquin Valley. But when you look at the San Joaquin Valley itself is three valleys. There's an east side, which is the citrus belt. And that's where a lot of the citrus families came up and over the mountain from L.A. as they were selling out that land for suburbia. And they planted their orchards in 1905, 1906 along the east side. It's a beautiful part of the valley. There's available water because five rivers run through it. And there are real farm communities there, almost in the agrarian ideal, places like Exeter and Porterville and Visalia, where the children of farmers and the children of farm workers go to school together. And then we move to the middle valley, what I call the center valley. And this is Raisin Land, Selma and Fowler. And the water table there, again, is very good because five rivers run through that land. And you can go down and get your water at 50, 60 feet. And so in those two places, the Center Valley and the East Valley, the relationship of the land to water creates a different kind of culture. On the west side where Resnick is, and that's in western Kern, and in western Fresno where the Westlands Water District is, these are places where there are no rivers running through it. And to get the water, you have to go 2,000 feet deep. Now, in western Kern, where Lost Hills is, there's another complication. The groundwater either doesn't exist or is so foul you couldn't put it on crops. So that's an area that was wholly dependent on the building of the State Water Project in the 60s. So Resnick is relying completely on the State Water Project, but also a water bank that he was able to acquire from the state of California. Our citizens had put $74 million into this water bank, but the state couldn't finish the job. So in a back room in Monterey in the 90s, that water bank was acquired by Resnick. And that water bank in flood years can hold a million acre feet of water. And so that gives him groundwater, except in drought, because after 5 years of drought, they've extracted all the water from the water bank, this underground kind of membrane that holds water, and the State Water Project was delivering zero. So I start driving through that empire at that time, thinking that they're going to be taking out tens of thousands of acres of orchards and things like this. What I find is they are growing another record crop. And so the question becomes, the mystery that pulls you through a section of that book is, how is this possible? How in the midst of the worst drought in California history are these big guys planting more acres?
And in the course of investigating that, you come across two 12-inch wide aluminum pipes. What are they?
Well, he got so desperate that he teamed up with another billionaire, a gentleman named Vidovich, who was a Silicon Valley boy, came up and over the mountain to basically buy farmland so he could sell the water.
Silicon Valley real estate and developer.
That's right. That's right. And so Vidovich has some land that's two and a half counties away from the orchards that Resnick needs his water. So Vidovich starts taking this water out of the ground. Now, mind you, this is an area where the subsidence is some of the worst in the world. The sinking of the land is so bad because they're extracting so much water out. So Vidovich takes this water out, moves it via ditches and canals across the old Tulare Lake bottom to the west side of the valley, and then they hook it up with these rain-for-rent pipes, and then they end up funneling that water. And it's not a great amount, but it's enough to get by to Resnick's orchards. At the same time, he's spending hundreds of millions of dollars buying water on the open market from wherever to try to get by. Eventually, the drought gets so bad that he does have to take out some acreage. But guess what's happened today with two wet years back-to-back? He's planting and adding even more. So that's the lesson of California. When we took the rivers, they wanted to grow more, so they ended up having the pumps to go down into the earth and take more. When the pumps couldn't go any deeper, they said, steal us a river. So the farmers of the middle ended up taking the flow from the Sacramento. And so the more water you have, the more crops you plant. The more crops you plant, the more water you need to have. And that's where we're at today. We've extended agriculture out very much like our model of suburbia. It's gone way too far out. It's no longer sustainable.
One of the most striking descriptions you have in the book is of the water, groundwater pumping operations, wells going up to 2,000 feet into the ground. And I hadn't realized that people who are effectively water brokers like this John Vidovich might take rights that they have to surface water, sell them off to developers, but then instead of retiring their agricultural operations, just drill more wells so that they can find water to keep the fields productive.
That's what's happening right now. In fact, with the Groundwater Sustainability Act, which is passed, but it's got a big run-up. I mean, it's like 15, 20 years. You're going to see a whole new reality here. In the meantime, though, what these farmers have done is they've drilled more to try to show a historic use. So when this modeling happens about sustainability, they could say, well, wait a second, we've been pumping water out of here for 10 years. You need to calculate that, state. You need to calculate that in what we can take in the future. But I think the state's going to hold the line on this, and I think what we're going to see is some real farmland. That footprint that went from, it started with the rivers and the alluvial plain, the best land. And then the pumps allowed you to go on to a little bit more marginal land. But what happened is drip irrigation allowed you to farm the worst land, where there was no rivers, and the groundwater was being tapped. So what's going to happen is as that shrinks back, you're going to see, the San Joaquin Valley has 6 million acres of farmland. You could probably see it go down to 4.5 million. The question becomes is what happens to that water that's saved? Will it go down the rivers? Will it go to other farmers who are farming primo land? Or will it go up and over the mountain so LA can sprawl more? Or will it go to our developers here so they can cover up this valley the way that the farmers in San Fernando did? And that to me is a great tragedy, because we need to have some farmland in California. We need to have this incredible place that grows things that no other place can continue to do that. And that's what this book tackles at the end.
I wanted to talk a little bit about you. You come from a farming family in the Central Valley, though the farm was lost by the time you were growing up in Fresno suburbs. What's kept you there? Most journalists, they want to advance their careers. That involves moving to a coast. There's a lot more publishers in New York than there are in Fresno. Why do you stay in the Valley? Why do you keep writing about it?
The Valley is the most incredible canvas anywhere. I mean, Saroyan discovered it, Steinbeck, Didion. You can't get stories like this anywhere. I mean, just the bending of resources, the guile it took to do what's been done, to see it happening, and all these folks coming from elsewhere, these migrants. My grandfather survived the Armenian genocide. He had a choice between going to poetry classes at the Sorbonne in Paris, coming to Fresno, where this one patriarch who'd survived the genocide was writing him letters. You must come here. There's a new Armenia. The grapes are the side of jade eggs. The watermelons, when you scoop out their flesh, you can then ride down them, in the irrigation canals. So my grandfather, has this choice, Paris, Fresno. He decides to come to Fresno. And all these migrations were playing out on the land. The Black Okies, the White Okies, the Japanese, the Swedes, the Chinese, the Volga Germans. These incredible stories. And many of them had come from places where government was something that controlled their lives and killed them. So they didn't want any government, and they found none here, and they just ended up doing what they did. And the raisin alone, if you just follow the raisin, you'd see that it's a metaphor. you know, the boom and the bust of the raisin. And this idea that we had to sell the raisin to the world. So we had these raisin ambassadors, these kids who would fly on planes and go sell the raisin to Europe. You know, we even tried to say we put raisin in toothpaste, raisin in everything, even your gravy. So, you know, it was California written another way. You know, the biggest dreamers in the world were here. They started here. So that's why I stay. And fortunately, I've found publishers in New York who think these stories are valuable. And you know, I'm really proud of this one. This I put in everything in here. I put our family story, a reportage from the land, and then all this historical archival research I did, trying to puzzle out this place. You know, this dumbness I had as a kid. You know, what irrigation canals slicing through our suburban neighborhoods, and I never thought to ask, where's that water coming from? Who's it going to? You know, by what right is it going there? You never ask these questions as a kid. And so all of my stories, all of my books have been about just trying to make myself a little less dumb to this place.
Well, Mark Arix, I'm grateful for the reporting you've done there and for the book. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak to us.
No, it's been fun. Thank you so much.
Mark Arix's new book is The Dreamt Land, Chasing Water and Dust Across California. And although he is based in Fresno, he'll be in San Francisco tonight giving a talk entitled The History of Water in California. That starts at 6:30 p.m. at Manny's. More detail at the website, Welcome to Manny's. That's MANNYS.com. And that takes us to 8:01 in the morning here at KPFA 94.1 FM in Berkeley, KPFB 89.3 FM in Berkeley, KFCF 88.1 FM in Fresno, K248BR 97.5 FM in Santa Cruz, and online around the world, www.kpfa.org. The program's up front. My name is Brian Edwards-Tiekert. When we come back, we'll have the debate before the San Francisco Board of Supervisors does today on whether the city should bar the sale, manufacture, and distribution of all tobacco products up to and including e-cigarettes on property that is owned or controlled by the city and county of San Francisco. It would be a first-of-its-kind rule in the nation. We'll have both sides on after the news.